Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Now I'm delighted to welcome to the show one of West Cork's leading winemakers, Graham Norton. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And listen, before we get on to viticulture, your latest book called Forever Home is out on paperback. And look, I'm kind of late to the party here, right? I have to confess, this is the first one of your books I've read. And it's really good. It's really good.
Oh.
And I said to a bookie kind of friend of mine, I'm reading a Graham Norton book and it's really good. And she said, oh yeah, I've read them all. Didn't you know? He's the new Maeve Binchy. Did you know this?
I mean, it's so nice for people to compare me to Maeve Binchy, who is, you know, she's the kind of the great. But I think I kind of benefited from people's expectations being incredibly low.
I didn't mean to sound so surprised, by the way, when I said it was really good. Yeah,
no,
okay.
I get it. And that's kind of, I think, been to my benefit, that people kind of expected the books to be. Mind you, I did kind of think when people started saying that, you know, oh, the books are good, I kind of thought, I wonder how bad they thought they were going to be.
You see, I suppose one of the things is I wasn't expecting you to have such a feel for, say, the texture and the details of kind of small lives in Bantry, as you deliberately don't call the town in the book, but it's Bantry. I suppose I imagined you'd be a bit kind of out of touch with that kind of life now.
It's interesting you say that. That was my real worry when I started writing these books, because I was setting them in West Cork, because that was kind of, you know, I didn't want me to be in the book, so I didn't want it to be in London or anything to do with telly or show business or anything. And, you know, you kind of think, what do I know about? Turns out, nothing. The only thing I knew was kind of life in rural Ireland. But, you know, I haven't lived in Ireland since the kind of early 80s. And, you know, and I go back a lot and I spend a few months every year and everything, but that's not the same as living somewhere. And so with the first book, Withholding, I did kind of think, oh, I hope, you know, have I got this right? Have I got this wrong? And it was so gratifying that Ireland really, really took to these books and started getting them. The only thing, in that first book, I got a letter from somebody and I was kicking myself. In the first book, I have a shop and I'm describing the shop and I do something about, you know, there's a kind of wilted spring onion in the veg display. And somebody said, do you mean scallion? And I thought, I got it wrong.
I think you'd say either. Scallion is quite posh. Spring onion, I would say, is more the phrase of the people. So listen, it is, I did realise then reading it, this is why he's spending more and more time in West Cork. So are you basically down there around with a notebook gathering material? Yeah. Could you just repeat that local idiom you just said?
I originally thought, oh, well, I'll kind of be in the house in West Cork and I'll be writing these books and it'll be lovely. And, you know, I'll just open the door and the dogs will run out. But actually, I tend to write them mostly in London and mostly when I'm busy doing other things, you know, because you know what it's like. If you're busy, you can get lots done.
Yeah.
The minute you stop work, suddenly, you know, boiling the kettle is a huge chore. So I tend to write them in London.
It's funny, though, isn't it, how that kind of small town Irish life, which was everything you had to run away from, it's become your material and also kind of has become your sanctuary in the summers, hasn't it?
It really has. And it's you're absolutely right. You know, I couldn't wait to get out of there. And you know, when I was leaving in the 80s, if somebody had said, you know, that I would willingly come back and spend time there, I thought they were nuts. And I don't know what, I think partly it's to do with having kind of a routine. So, you know, like me walking around Bantry now is no big deal because, you know, I go there every summer and people see me around. The other thing I like is I know lots of the other people walking around Bantry. You know, whereas in London, if you're walking around and people go, oh, Graham Norton, that's kind of freakish because, well, I don't know who that is. Mm. But in Bantry, my job is slightly more exotic, but equally, you know, they know me. I know them. I know, oh, that's the woman who works in Super Value, or that's the guy in the butchers, or that's the guy who fixes things, you know, all of that. Yeah. And I suppose I kind of, I like that.
Yeah, so it's a bit more egalitarian for you in a strange way. Do they studiously ignore you? Because they do seem very proud about how they give you your privacy and they won't tell anyone about your wedding and all that. So I imagine, do they start ignoring you to the point of rudeness, like?
But no. You get these people. I remember being in Super Value and pushing my trolley, and this woman kind of peering around a pile of cans, going, "It must be great not being bothered." And I was thinking, it was a minute ago.
Do that again. You remember a certain type of Cork voice there? Do it again.
No, go on. Performing monkey.
People in Cork will love it. Do that once more.
No more.
Okay. I'm going to trick you into doing that voice once again before the end of the interview. Come here, just in case you'd be getting notions. I remember when it must have emerged that you had a house in Ahakista, right? My mother's from Glengariff, right? No time for Ahakista, and she's old school West Cork. So I said, "Did you see Graham Norton has bought a house in Ahakista, apparently?" And she said, "You wouldn't have given a fiver for the whole of Ahakista in my day." So there you go. She's also bemused by the fact that Ballyhob has become a kind of a shishi enclave as well. Like, she said Ballyhob was a kind of a God help us place in her day. So what did draw you back then?
It's sad in a way, but the reason I started coming back more is because my father got ill. My father had Parkinson's. And so because of that, I was coming back more often. Because, you know, when I left, I was in my 20s. And you sort of think your parents are going to live forever and, you know, I'll go, nothing will change. And that was a big wake-up call. And then my father died. And when he died, that was such a kind of traumatic time. But the people in Bandon were so good at it. And it made me kind of fall in love with Ireland in a way again, because it just sort of reminded me that lots of that kind of small town stuff that I've been running away from, it has benefits as well. You know, it can be really claustrophobic and limiting, but also really supportive and lovely. And that was kind of when I fell in love with Ireland again. And it also, you know, because my dad was gone, you kind of thought, well, you know, I need to spend more time here. I need to see my mom more and my family more. And also, I think by then I had a bit of money in my pocket. So I was able to come back forward.
Yeah, and I know you didn't go back. You didn't go back and get a house in Bandon, I know. So you went a bit further up the road.
I feel it was a good distance from my mother, where, you know, close enough, but, you know, she won't just pop over. Like, she will call before she's coming over to see me.
Yeah. So, as you say, in your 20s when you went away, you're actually, as of 2 weeks ago, you are now a gentleman in your 60s.
I know.
You're kind of a settled country Protestant now, aren't you, kind of thing?
Yeah, I just need a horse.
Is 60 a big psychological barrier?
It was, but somehow now that I've done it, it still freaks me out, I suppose. It seems weird to think that I'm 60, because, you know, old people are 60.
Yeah.
I'm not old. It is odd. But look, you know, it's better to be 60 than in the grave at 59. So all good. And actually, I do, you know, I guess I know I feel healthy and well and all, you know, all the good things. But it is slightly shocking that I look in a mirror and go, wow, you're 60. That's something.
Yeah, I think 50, I kind of was able to bargain with it a bit, like, well, you know, 50 is still young now and all that, but I don't know, 60 just, it's harder to bargain that 60 is still a young man, isn't it?
For me, I thought 40 was a bit of a shock. 40, I found shocking.
Really?
And then 50 just felt like more 40.
Why was 40 such a shock?
Just 40 seemed, I don't know, I didn't know who I was at 40, if you know what I mean. I didn't know. Yeah. I, you know, that kind of thing. You kind of go, what does a 40-year-old wear? What does a 40-year-old eat? I just didn't know. I didn't know how to be 40. Whereas I think I'm, you know, I'm more settled now. I think literally I didn't know how to be me when I was 40. My life was in a, you know, a kind of chaos. I was kind of, I'd left Channel 4. I was sort of in New York working here. You know, I was single. But my life was all over the place. So I feel much more settled at 60.
And are you happy or settled, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think not being settled is a young man's game,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's all phases, you know, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Because that's when you're hungry and that's when you're after things and stuff. Now I'm just, you know, I'm in a really lovely position where I've got a few gigs and I love them all. You know, I write the books and I really enjoy doing that. And then I've got the chat show, the radio show and the wine, and that's me sorted. And
a few little gigs, yeah. So yeah. When was it then that, we won't dwell on this, right? But I do want to ask you one, because I'm kind of, you know, I'm in the middle of 40 and 60, so I'm curious about this. When did you kind of feel you grew into yourself or settled into yourself then?
I suppose my late 40s. I think by the time I was 50, I felt pretty secure. And I think that's also the nature of what we do, you know, in that there is no security. Yes, I've got a successful show on BBC One, but it only takes a new person to be in charge of BBC One to go, you know what, time for a change. And that's the end of me. I think you'd be an idiot to feel secure and settled early on. So I think in my late 40s was kind of, I felt, yeah, my feet were under the table and I was going to be okay for a while. Certainly by the time I was 50, I felt okay. But I liked my 50s. My 50s were great. So hopefully my 60s will be all right. It's just that thing now that you feel like everything's out to get you when you're 60. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Like steps, pavements, cars, bikes. Everything's really, trying to kill you.
Oh, God. And did settling down and getting married and all that, was that all kind of part of that process as well of maturing and mellowing and...
I felt I was kind of going to be, you know, very happy as a single man. I was going to be one of those older single men, you know, a bachelor. That's what I was going to be. Yeah, I was going to be your Protestant country bachelor. And with, you know, a great group of friends and all of those things. And so
cultured and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
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 So when Jono came along, that was just a great surprise. It was a lovely surprise. But it wasn't like I suppose once it happens, you kind of think, oh, wow, life is so much better like this. But it wasn't like I was miserable before Jono came along. But it is great that that's happened.
Yeah. And how is married life?
It's good so far. We're only a year in.
So are you still in a kind of a honeymoon period and all that? Are you still very romantic and crazy?
I'm going with yes.
Who's chasing who in it, do you think? Are you the beloved and is he the lover? Or are you the lover and is he the beloved?
Well, I think it's like any relationship, you know, those things change, don't they? You know, one day it's one day it's the next. But we seem pretty content. I mean, I'd say that, you know, you'd have to talk to him.
You have a gay married couple in the book, actually. And it's kind of interesting because they're kind of an unhappy gay married couple who possibly shouldn't have got married and maybe only got married because gay marriage suddenly became an option. And I was thinking, is this not a bit off message slightly?
Well, I thought it was, I liked putting that in because I like that idea in Ireland that like there's so many gay couples, there was almost like a shotgun wedding thing going on,
yes,
where people are like, oh God, now you voted for it, I suppose we'll have to do it. You know, all your friends have been campaigning, going from house to house. You kind of go, thanks for that. Now I'll have to get married. So I quite liked that idea. And I liked writing them. They made me laugh, that couple.
Yeah, they are good fun. And the travel agent who never travels, Yeah, God help us. There's a fantastic character in the book then who's kind of the mother of the heroine, in a sense, or the mother of the main character, Moira, who's this 80-year-old kind of woman of action in a gilet with a kind of that haircut that women get at a certain point. Now, I don't want to be mean to Rhoda, but is Moira slightly based on your mother, Rhoda? Because I saw you say somewhere you were jotting down Rhoda's utterances recently.
Well, she's not my mother, but there are elements of my mother. Like, my mother has that thing of, which Moira has, her version of silence in the car. So driving the car, and her version of silence is actually a monologue about, you know, I'd hate to live there. She always is washing out. Yeah. That dog will get killed. You know, just this endless flow of commentary as you drive along. So my mother does do that. So that's where that comes from, Moira. Yeah. And there are elements of my mother, but also I think there are elements of Irish mothers. I think there's a big thing with Irish mothers that they demonstrate their love. They show their love by doing rather than by saying. You know what I mean? They mind you and they'll take action for you and all of those things. And I really like that.
I see that now. Yeah, because Moira really does come through, doesn't she? In a way that we might think initially she's not going to be a great emotional support or something, but she's pragmatic, yeah. For a man, you do write great women. I think you find women more interesting than men, do you?
Well, they are more interesting than men. I mean, men, you know, you know yourself, you are one. We are quite simple creatures, really. We're quite dog-like, you know. Can we eat it or can we, you know, do something else to it? Yeah. That's about it. Whereas I think women navigate the world in a much more nuanced way, and they read the room more than men. And, you know, I just think to write female characters is more interesting because the way they kind of navigate things, it has to be more complicated than I think it is for a lot of men. I think gay men have some kind of female energy in that way, in that I think gay men are often reading the room because, you know, because a lot of the time you're quite vulnerable if you're out in the world, particularly if you're out in a male world, you feel quite vulnerable.
Still.
Less, I mean, certainly at 60, a lot less. but I think, I don't know, I'm not a young gay man, but probably, I imagine. What's weird is, you know, I think what's sweet is, you know, kids talk about coming out and, you know, oh, did they come out? And of course, coming out never stops. You know, even now, you know, in terms of being a well-known homosexual, I am kind of up there, and I'll still be in the back of a cab on the first, you know, nice summer's day, and the cab driver will say something about, you know, girls in summer dresses or, you know, that. And you kind of, you're sitting in the back of the cab going, like, do I tell him? Do I now come out to a cab driver or do you just smile and nod along? It's all of that. It's and that never stops. And I think a lot of kind of young kids don't get that bit of their life. It's like, this isn't going to stop. This is something you're going to be doing for the rest of your life.
Wow. Even if you're Graham Norton, because I think people...
I know. People, I mean, I put the work in.
But people would think that you're reasonably bulletproof and that you're so out there that, you know, it's done. But you still have that, you wouldn't call it microaggressions, but micro incidences running through your life.
Yeah, well, just that thing of kind of, you know, you have to make that decision. Am I going to? And some of it, and I think this is less now, but some of it goes back to that great... speech that Panty Bliss gave at the Abbey that night, you know, the checking yourself. I think that was such a great speech. I thought Panty really kind of nailed something there that is deep in the kind of gay psyche.
Yeah, wow. And what about down in West Cork?
Well, what's weird is, you know, it's absolutely fine. And I don't know, is that because I'm Graham Norton off the telly? I hope not. I hope it's okay for, you know, some young kid there as well. If they decide they're gay, I hope it's okay for them too. But that I, you know, my experience now is so different in a way, because it comes through all these filters. It comes through the filters of kind of me being well known. It comes through a filter of wealth. It comes filter of living in a big house. You know, all of those, yeah. all of those things change all of that. So I hope it's as good for everybody.
Yeah, you see, and in a way, you would like to think as well that you being down there, and I don't want to say normalizing homosexuality at this stage of the game, like, but you being down there, and that there might be people who might not have just taken that in their stride, but if they take it in their stride with you, that maybe they'll take it in their stride a little bit more in the rest of their lives as well. Was your mother, when you told her first, I know you've probably been over all this, but seeing as we've gone down this road, just one more question about it. When you told your mother first, you would think of a lot of mothers would go, they would worry for their son.
I think there was a real thing in the past where a mother or a parents, they realized that you weren't going to have their family life. You weren't going to replicate their family life. And so to them, it seemed like you were going to have a lonely life, because you weren't going to get married. You weren't going to have kids. You weren't going to do all the things they'd done. And I understand that. I understand that you suddenly think, oh, my child is going to have this terrible, lonely existence. But of course, one, now you can do all those things. You can get married and you can have kids. But even before that, you know, you found your own. Yeah, Armistead Maupin has a great phrase. You know, you've got your biological family, and then you have your logical family, and it's those are the people you find. Those are all the people you find along the way. You pick up members of your tribe, and you bond with them in a way, you know, that is like family. It's really kind of profound and deep, but you can't explain that to a woman who's living in West Cork, and, you know, she's made very different life choices.
She probably gets it now, does she?
Oh, no, totally, yeah. totally now. And before, you know, I was married or anything, I mean, I think she understands my kind of friendship group, and she meets them all, and, you know, they come and stay in Ireland every summer. And so, yeah, no, she totally gets it.
You write a very well-sketched depiction of one of the characters, Declan, going through, I think, dementia and the various stages of that. But you write it so well and so accurately and with all the little detail and everything that I'm thinking, is it something you're familiar with? Was it kind of based on your dad's journey, last journey with Parkinson's or something?
Bits of it were certainly based on my dad's journey with Parkinson's, but also, you know, at my age, an awful lot of my friends have gone through this with parents. And it's just the most awful thing to see and to experience. It's just because, you know, it's one of those things, it doesn't even do you the favor of killing you. You know, it just steals you bit by bit. And so I'm glad you say that. I'm glad you thought it was well done, because, you know, you don't want to get it wrong. And that's why in the book, I never diagnose him. I never actually say what he's got, because I wanted it to be kind of more general than that. It's just, you know, a degenerative disease that is taking him.
Yeah. It's beautifully done. And if you, we don't need to dwell on this either, but did you watch your father kind of taken like that, Graham, as well, slowly recede away from you? Yeah.
I mean, with Parkinson's, it's a much more physical thing, less mental. But I think what happens is, you know, as you're physically diminished, your world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. That's kind of part of that, to the point where by the end, when somebody goes, it's awful. And you know, it was the saddest thing that's ever happened in my life was losing my father. But at the same time, you wouldn't wish him to be alive in that state. You know, if he was to be alive, you'd want him to be the dad you knew, not that man. And that was kind of the gift of him dying, was you got to remember him. He got to live again as kind of, you know, your well dad, you know, the dad you knew. And sort of, I never really remember him as the man in the bed in the nursing home. That man kind of went when he died. And our memories are all of him when he was well.
Yeah, that's fantastic, isn't it? I think it's a thing that happens for a lot of people. Okay, listen, in terms of other stuff coming up, you've got Eurovision. It's coming from Liverpool this year on behalf of Ukraine, kind of. And now you're hosting it for the first time, but you're still going to be doing your kind of commentary that people enjoy so much. How is that going to work? Are you going to be taking the piss out of yourself?
Well, basically, like so many things in life, I got this idea from the late great Terry Wogan, because when they last did it in Birmingham, Terry did this. He did the commentary and hosted. So I basically, they asked me to host and I thought, oh, I want to host. And then I was thinking, I'll kick myself if I don't, because I'll never get the chance to host again. So what the hell, I'll do it. So, but I thought, I don't want to give up the commentary gig entirely because, you know, the chance of someone else being better than me, quite high. And then I have lost my gig. So I said, can I still do most of the commentary? So I'm doing most of the commentary. And then I think during the voting sequence, Mel Gedroych is going to take over. And then I'll be on stage with Hannah Waddingham doing the voting, the 12 point bit.
Okay, so you are going to have to kind of have a split personality that night slightly.
Yeah, but also it is, you're absolutely right though, it is going to be harder because normally, you know, you could just laugh at it if it's bad or boring.
Yeah.
But we, this year, the BBC have made it. So
yes.
So we have to be a bit...
I think respectful is the word you're looking for, Graham, is it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And listen, other things you're doing. Last One Laughing Ireland, which is for Amazon. And this is a show with Irish comedians, is it?
Yeah, there's, I think, they haven't announced the comedians yet, so I'll say nothing. But there's big names there. You will know them. I mean, you'll probably know all of them. It's a really simple game. They're all put in a room. Their challenge is not to laugh, but they're all trying to make each other laugh. And whoever laughs last wins. Get it? This show has been a huge hit. It's been rolled out globally.
Okay.
I think in Germany, they're on season 5. And
they're known for, you know, their comedy.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Very long season.
Yes, exactly. And everyone won. Yeah. Nobody laughed.
Yeah. Day 72, still no one has laughed.
By the way, did you go back and do some stand-up recently?
Oh, kind of, yes. I did a thing.
Why would you want to draw? I mean, you're doing well. Why would you want to draw that hell on yourself again after all these years?
What it was, you know, the big thing in Montreal, the Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
It's a big comedy festival in Montreal. So they decided to do Just for Laughs London. And so they had the O2 for the weekend. And so they asked me, but what was nice was I wasn't really doing stand-up, you know, I was just hosting
Okay.
So I was really just introducing actual proper stand-ups. Yeah, but it was a shock to the system.
You'll be doing that again soon, will you?
No, I will not.
So listen, I mean, people will hear from all that and you've got the books and of course you've got your, the viticulture as well, which we never got around to, but there you go. You know what I'm building up to here. You've said yourself, it's a precarious game show business, right? I know it's been going well for you now for 30 years or whatever, but we know not the time nor the hour. There is a gig going back here in Dublin. You've fallen in love with the country again and everything. Could you be tempted back to do the Late Late?
No, that job is so hard. That job is such a hard gig, you know, because I chip away at a very silly bit of show business and I just talk to actors, musicians and get into stuff. The Late Late Show, you have to cover so much stuff. You know, you have to be across so many things and the changes of tone and also that show's so long. Being on it is hard work.
I feel they'd shorten it for you if you agree to it. I feel they'd cut it back a bit. Maybe end at 11. You could still get to the pub in time. Okay, listen, thank you so much for your time and your generosity today. And Forever Home is out now in paperback. Graham Norton, thank you so much.